Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm your host, Chicago writer Dave Hoekstra. In this first of two segments, we revisit the Chicago Fest experience at Navy Pier. We catch up with Kathy Byrne, the daughter of late Chicago Mayor Jane Byrne, Marilyn Gardner, the president and CEO of Navy Pier, Norm Weiner, the longtime program director of WXRT-FM in Chicago, and members of the Chicago rhythm and blues band Third Rail, who had to change their name after appearing at Chicago Fest. Thanks to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum Exhibits Director Lance Towser and the museum's Garrett West for production and editing. For more information on other podcasts and our State of Sound exhibit, please check out musicfromillinois.com. And now, here's Kathy Byrne.
But what are your memories of Chicago?
It was such a joyous, wonderful, exhausting, exciting week that I would spend every summer just going up and down Navy Pier, learning about new music, going to my favorite music, and just being just awestruck by how fun it was.
Roughly, how old were you? Teenager?
I was 20 okay. when my mom became mayor.
Okay.
So the first Chicago Fest was the year before she became mayor.
Right.
So I was 19 for that one.
Okay.
And I didn't get to go to it. That was the horror of it. I stood in front of the gates of Chicago Fest getting people to sign petitions to get my mom on the ballot. And literally my tongue was hanging out of my head wanting to go so badly.
That's interesting. Yeah. I did not know that story.
Right at the gate. And I was like, oh, why can't I go?
Yeah. So what was the first one like? And, you know, I kind of want to dial into, like, the music. What personally, what music were you listening to? Who did you see? What do you remember?
I mean, these are all very odd memories that just come up. But I remember the first one. The Blues Brothers, of course.
Okay.
But personally, I was asked to introduce Bobby Vinton, who had a big hit, you know, the year before, A Melody of Love.
Very good. Yeah.
Which was in Polish. And so I introduce him, and then, you know, I'm skedaddling off the stage, and he grabs my arm, and he's like, no, no, no. So he's like, join me. I didn't know the words. So you know, that was, you know, I'm sort of mouthing. And he said, okay, well, that's not fair, because, you know, I know you're Irish. So let's sing When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
Mm.
Now, my voice is, I mean, people remember my mom singing off-key and badly and loudly. My voice makes her sound like a choir of angels. And I love to sing, and I don't care that it's so terrible. So I am just, when Irish eyes, I am belting it out. And he's kind of cringing. But then, did you know there's a second verse?
Oh, I didn't know.
Me neither. So then I'm up there like a dummy, not knowing the words to the second verse of When Irish Eyes Are Smiling.
So what'd you do? Just improvise?
I just, I would just kind of, yes, always, smiling, glowing,
yeah.
Any ing word I could think of. So,
we mentioned Paul Mackin, actually. I think he shot the pictures. So talk about the Blues Brothers picture. I think that's going to be in the exhibit.
Okay.
You and your mom. It's iconic now.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. It was, you know, it was, we were backstage. Now, my mom had met them because they'd been to her office and, you know, they developed an immediate rapport. But I was, you know, my eyes were bugging out of my head. I'm standing here with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd and... So they're just kind of chatting, talking, and then they said, you know, why don't we take a few pictures? So, you know, we posed for the very, you know, stiff and solemn one. And then all of a sudden, like, and then Aykroyd takes off his hat and puts it on my head. And I'm like, and then my mom starts just, and so she does the thing, you know, like her nowadays they would say they were gang signs, but she kind of does a thing like she's shooting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a big wink, and then we're putting the sunglasses on, and it was, you know, it was amazing.
It was iconic. Yeah. Do you remember their show at all?
Mm-hmm.
Chicago Fifth?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did Soul Man.
Yeah.
They did Rolling.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. And crowds were big.
Yeah, crowds were huge.
Yeah.
It was almost better that my mom had it like its second year, because it wasn't just, you know, some crazy idea that she had. In fact, she didn't want to have it at first.
I read that, yeah. Did you guys, did they look at what was going on in Milwaukee at all with Summerfest and stuff? And,
yeah, because I think the Festivals Inc. people done Summerfest first.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they came down here and they did it the first year, and which would have been the summer of 79. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people didn't know what it was going to be, but they did, they got a lot of people,
yeah,
enough to fill out petitions.
Yeah.
But then when she got elected, she was like, we can't afford this, which was, you know, now I'm down at school and I hear this because we had,
where were you at school?
St. Mary's at Notre Dame. So, you know, there's not going to be any Chicago Fest. I literally, like, put on the Channel 9 news, watched it, walked out, got in the car, drove home, and said, you can't do this to me. I stood there for 3 days getting signatures. You can't do this to me. And she said, well, you know, you're not the first one to say that I shouldn't do this. But, okay, you're going to be the last one. We'll do it.
I want to talk a little bit just about your mom and set things up a little bit. What was it like around the house? Was there music around the house? I mean, she was very much into the arts.
Yeah, she was very, yeah. She
about
loved
what it was like
music.
Growing up like that.
Well, I mean, you know, constant battles about, you know, who was going to control the radio, you know, where, you know, I would be, you know, putting on, you know, rock stations and pop stations, and she would be like some pop, but, you know, I mean, she was, you know, born in, you know, the late 30s. So, yeah. I mean, you know, she wanted to hear, you know, Frank Sinatra. She wanted, you know, to hear, you know, Elvis, which, you know, to me was just cringeworthy. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, whoever was driving got control of the radio.
Yeah.
So that was how that worked. And then, you know, I mean, we had, what did we call it back in the day? We had stereo systems and records and,
And she, before mayor, she was in consumer affairs. So talk about how progressive she was. I mentioned I stay in my lane, and I want to stay in my lane writing this stuff, but she was, she stopped the hassling of gays and stuff like that. So talk about that. She was kind of, well, she was the first to do that.
Right.
First mayor to do that.
She was the first to do that. And I mean, I think it was a no-brainer for her. It was like, wait, why would they go into bars and start hitting people? What are they doing in the bars that you're hitting them? You know, and, you know, police commanders would be like, well, it's, you know, there might be stuff going on there. And she was like, well, there's stuff going on in every bar in Chicago. You're not going in and beating people. What is this?
Yeah, right.
You know, and so, I mean, it wasn't something that there was a lot of awareness of. But it wasn't right. And so it's kind of like, you know, once you know, you have to do something.
Yeah.
And I think that was also sort of a big difference in, you know, because we had just had, you know, decades of, what did they say, you know, next to the Kremlin, you know, City Hall is the most opaque structure in the world. So it would be, you know, no one would want to bring that to prior mayor's attention, you know, don't bring it up, you know. And, you know, my mom was, you know, a lot more accessible, and stuff would be brought up. Well, we have to do this. And I'm not saying that prior mayors wouldn't have, but I'm sure they just didn't know. They were blocked off.
Talk about what it looked like. Talk about, you know, people, even when they were putting together this exhibit, I go, don't sleep on the Navy Pier connection. Let's stay the sound. Right. And so explain what it's like, what it looked like, what it smelled like, you know?
Well, Navy Pier was very old. And, you know, in the during World War II, it was used by the Navy for training. And they had an officer's candidate school there, and they trained with boats. So they're the Navy. Then it was the first U of I campus in Chicago. So then it became a campus. And then it just sort of became this white elephant. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, it was there, and it's, you know, half a mile out into the water. It was not in great shape. The plumbing wasn't good. It was, you know, leaking. You didn't want the pier to fall in the water. But it was, you know, you had what you call the head house, and then the promenade, and then the ballroom down at the end. And they did the stages all along the south side of the pier. And you had some stages that were actually floating docks. You had the Budweiser dock. It was floating. Depending on where the bays were on that side of the pier, you could either have the stage built into the bay, and then people could gather, you know, between the bay and the water.
That's great stuff. I forgot that.
Yeah. or you filled it the other way. If it was a bigger show, you wanted the performers by the water because you didn't want the audience falling in the water. So that was like a safety thing. And then down at the end, there was, I think there was like a kids area. And then there were, I think jazz was down at the end. And they tried to make it, as much as you could on Navy Pier, they tried to make it like kind of a jazz club, the environment, a little more sophisticated. And then you also had the oldies stage, which was in a recessed bay. I remember the Budweiser dock. And then on the inside, where, you know, now they have probably where the exhibit is going to be, yeah. They had all the food. So you had all these food vendors, and then you also had the food vendors on the outside. Then you had the main stage, which was not on the pier itself. It was in that area that is now a park, because that could hold the most people. And you had seating, and then you had festival, you know, standing, moshing, whatever you needed, for the main stage. But either way, all of it was on the south end. So you were facing, if you were facing the stage, you were looking at the skyline and the lake. And that was what they came up with the idea for the logo, is the note on the water, the music note on the water.
That's right, yeah, yeah. It's very good.
I hung out a lot.
Oh, that's great. Do you remember, kind of going back to one of the earlier questions, do you remember certain acts you saw there? And did you have like a bodyguard with you or security?
They were pretty laid back.
Yeah,
I would always have one when I was going, and then he would kind of make sure I was in my seat if it was main stage, and then my friends and I would kind of head in. And we were like, I don't know if you remember the loop.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
The big thing then was kids to wear the black loop t-shirts.
Yeah, everybody's saying that, yeah.
Which I gladly wore.
You did?
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because all the girls wanted to look like, I think her name was Laura Lee.
Yeah, Laura. Yeah.
We all
wanted,
I mean, none of us did, but, you know, we thought we did.
That's good.
The one act that I, to this day, stays in my mind was Aretha Franklin. Unbelievable show. I mean, she went on and on. It was, you know, I mean, she did Respect. She did, you know, Shake Your Tail Feather. I mean, it was, you know, and I think she closed with Natural Woman. I mean, it was a great, great show. That was I think, out of all the years, that was my favorite.
So I think I might have covered the first Taste of Chicago. But did your mom, I know she was friends with Arnie Morton, but, and again, I researched this. Did they look at Finale Hall? Did they look at what they were doing in Boston and what other cities were doing with the waterfronts and stuff like that?
They did. I remember she went on a trip that was the developer. Rouse Corporation. Mm-hmm. And he did Faneuil Hall. He did Quincy Market. He did the Baltimore waterfront and one other city. And they went on like a little like field trip to all of those places and looked at them. And the original pier redevelopment was supposed to make it a lot like Quincy Market, mm-hmm. Permanent year round, you know, with a venue. And then I, yeah, politics in Chicago changes everything. So.
Do you go back there much? Do you go back to Navy Pier much?
You know, I used to live in Streeterville, uh-huh. and I did. I love Navy Pier, and I would just walk it. You know, we used to when my mom was mayor, my friends and I would sometimes just go there for picnic lunch. Like there was no festival, they were getting ready for it, or it was over. But we would just go out there and hang out with the Festival Inc. guys and have picnic lunches in the head house, and then walk the prom. I mean, it was, yeah, it was just, it was a heavenly place.
About the boycott. Now, I've heard two things. Again, my research said it was CHA appointments, but then some of these musicians are telling me it was vendors. So what do you know about the boycott and how'd your mom handle that? And what year was that?
That was 82.
Okay.
Okay. It was actually, I think, the school board appointments that were the final straw. And the black community had been looking for a candidate. And Harold Washington was the most logical candidate. And Harold said, I'm not doing it unless you show me you can register. I don't know what the number was, 150,000, but a huge, over 100,000 new voters. And, you know, raise, you know, show me that you don't have to raise it right now, but you have to show me that you can raise $500,000. And you do those two things, I'll get it done. And, so it was not, I mean, it's not easy to register that many voters, and it's certainly not easy to raise money for somebody who's not even running. So things were sort of, you know, iffy. And then when, and that was after, I think there were CHA appointments that did not go over, but then the school board appointments were the final straw. And then Operation Push said, we are going to boycott Chicago Fest. You know, that's Janie's favorite event. We are going to boycott it. And they got the, Stevie Wonder, you know, said, I'm not coming. He was going to honor the boycott. And Cool and the Gang said, oh, well, we're honoring it too, but in our own way. We're going to wear black armbands. Yeah. Oh, okay. But I mean, it was very successful. I mean,
it was successful.
Yeah, I mean, there were picketers and all of that.
Did it really keep? I've read different. Did it really keep people away?
No.
Yeah. Right.
No, but I mean, their point, I think, was not so much to keep people away, but to bring attention to the voter registration thing, and they got, you know, it helped them get their voters registered. But I mean, no, I mean, everybody went.
Yeah. What was your mom's take on that?
She was just amazed that something that was supposed to be, you know, for everybody, you know, was being picked out to be the thing that, you know, because I mean, it was not a good economy at the time, and that was sort of the purpose of having all these festivals was here's something that is like free or $5 and you can go do this, and this is top flight entertainment, and you know. So, I mean, I think she was saddened, but you know.
You know, you talk about it being. I'm kind of going off my script here, but you talk about being for everybody, and I have looked at. I saved a lot of stuff, and I've looked at programs, and man, it was booked. There were diverse acts. I mean, you had Latin, you had the polka,
what?
You had. I told my buddy from the John Prine that you had Henny Youngman. You had Sinatra, you had Aretha. It was really...
I think we had Cab Calloway.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very diverse. It was very, yeah, it was amazing. Lou Valpaino was the booker.
I know Lou. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Did he ever tell you the Frank Sinatra story?
No, he might have. I haven't talked to Lou in a while, but he's out west. He's not around
here. California.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead.
My mom was, bound and determined to get Frank Sinatra. Oh, my God, did she want Frank Sinatra. And, she could have, stopped being mayor the day after Frank Sinatra performed at Chicago Fest. That's how much she wanted Sinatra. So, and it was, no, he's not going to do, he doesn't do this kind of thing. I want Sinatra. And she's asking everybody and their brother if they've got any entrees to Frank. And they're quite a few people in Chicago who do. Mm-hmm. But Lou got him. Lou called me and said, do not breathe a word of this. Do not tell your mother until I've got a signed contract. But we're going to have Sinatra. And he's like, we're going to have to kind of change the schedule around because of when he can come. But we've got him. But you can't tell anybody. Right. So this is maybe on, let's say, a Monday, right? So I'm really excited, and I don't tell anyone. And, on Wednesday, Alderman so-and-so calls. Mayor, I have it on good authority from, a contact I have in Vegas that, And then somebody says, Mayor, I was able to get, Sinatra. I called in a few favors. 10 people called her to say that they got him. And I'm like... I'm like, Mom, Lou Valpano called me a week ago.
Right kind of town. Chicago, 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 right kind.
Next, we'll talk with Marilyn Gardner, the longtime president and CEO of Navy Pier.
And what are your memories like? I'm asking everybody, with Chicago Fest and stuff, what do you remember? What did the pier look like? When you talk about redevelopment, what was the scene like?
Sure. Well, my first memory of Navy Pier is actually Chicago Fest when I came for the Buckinghams. And I recently looked up the date. It was August 1st of 1981.
Really?
Or 80. I'm sorry. 1980. August 1st of 1980. So I was a freshman going into my sophomore year in high school at St. Ignatius College Prep.
Right.
I also had the opportunity to see John Prine at Chicago Fest that same summer. And then you may recall that in 95, John Prine also performed at Skyline Stage. And he performed there 95 and 96. And I was then the publicist or the PR representative for Skyline Stage and ultimately Navy Pier. So what an incredible experience for me as a young person to have my first, literally my first memories of Navy Pier tie back to some of my first responsibilities.
Can you describe what, two-point question, what it was like physically here and also what the... what the music was like as far as diversity and all the different acts and stuff.
Well, so again, my memories, my initial memories of Chicago Fest, I remember an oddly, a sea of Madras plaid. And so it was when I attended the concerts, preppy crowd, dilapidated sheds that really... were the distance between the far west end and east end of the pier and in between just masses of people and music stages and food and, smells of food and festival type atmosphere, but just a sea of people. And for some reason, that Madras plaid sticks in my mind.
People are also talking about the Loop t-shirts.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. And one of my older brothers, I had two older brothers, one of them actually worked at Chicago Fest, and so that's where we got the tickets. He was working on stage setup, so that's how my high school friends and I got our tickets.
Kathy Burns said they all wanted to be like Lorelai. Remember that? She was like the face of the Loop.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. That's right.
So they were all like,
yeah.
Did you wander around, see other acts? It was booked so diversely. I was looking at the schedule. They had Henny Youngman. They had Latin music.
Right. So I, unfortunately, I don't have the clearest memory of wandering around. It's really, you know, I focused on the people, and I distinctly remember those two concerts, so yeah. Buckingham's and John Prine. So those were the ones that really touched me, or those were the ones that we had specifically come to see. But just being in the festival atmosphere, it was something I had never experienced before, and I think something that, you know, has really impacted me in my life. Raising my children, we went to neighborhood festivals every weekend. In college, up at Marquette University, we, you know, went to see every band we could, and the more festival-like, the better. So I'm a big festival goer, and I think truly my first experience and exposure to festival was Chicago Fest right here at Navy Pier, where now I have the privilege of serving as the president and CEO.
We'll now hear from Norm Weiner, the 2015 recipient of Chicago's Fifth Star Award, the first media figure to be so honored for contributing to the arts and culture of the city of Chicago.
Chicago Fest. What were you doing? Where were you at when Chicago Fest started? 79, 80, 81? Well, tell me your background there.
I came to Chicago and just before Labor Day 1979.
Okay.
And it was a steaming hot day when they had a party to welcome me as the new program director of XRT. We had one program director in the history of the station for the previous 7 years, John Platt, great man. But he left, I replaced him, and it was a steaming hot day. We were at Wise Fool's Pub, and Lonnie Brooks was playing that day. Uh-huh. He'll come back up to the story later. Yeah. And people were saying, where are you from? I said, well, San Francisco. I mean, I hadn't lived in San Francisco for more than a few years, but I'm from the East Coast, lived in New York, lived in Boston, and then I moved to San Francisco. But he said, oh, man, what are you doing here? You know, it's so friggin' cold here, and they use more colorful language than that. And all they could talk about with the temperature 105 degrees and the 100 whatever humidity, all they could talk about was how incredibly cold it is in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. That was the winter that Michael Bolandic lost his gig
right.
because he didn't clear the streets, replaced by Jane Byrne, the first female mayor of Chicago. And the whole point was that she created something that would be a lasting legacy for her, and that was Chicago Fest.
So you come here from San Francisco, and Chicago Fest kind of looked at what Summerfest was doing in Milwaukee. Did you know anything what was going on in Milwaukee? Was that new to you?
Or? Yeah, no, that was astounding. Still remains astounding. Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing, you know, musical venture.
Yeah. So you get up, you learn about Chicago Fest. So how does XRT get on board?
Well, let me throw in a quick story.
Okay, sure.
Because, you know, again, all they did, they were obsessed with the heat. They were obsessed with the wintry conditions, yeah. You know, and yet, you know, here it was a blazing hot day. And all of those days, you know, leading into September were blazing hot. And I needed a name to be on the radio because I didn't want to use my real name because I didn't want people to call me up and critique the station and make suggestions or ask for jobs or complain about the commercials or whatever. So I said, well, if they have a love-hate relationship with the winter, then I'm going to add a T to my name because my name's spelled W-I-N-E-R, and I'll be Norm Winter. And I tried it for a couple of days on the air, and I said, you know what? I think I need to add – it doesn't feel right.
You could have gone out with Johnny Winter.
Well, there were some other people, you know, too. I thought I'd add an S to it because it kind of felt better, and it sort of implied longevity that I was planning to be here for a while, though that wasn't originally the plan. That is another story. But so Norm Winters, boom, and then that stuck. And it was all because of, you know, people's immediate impression. But the importance of the summer was, you know, we had everything to do. People were outside, and as someone shared with me, can I say the word shit?
Yeah.
Okay, so if someone shared to me, one of my first friends when I moved to Chicago, in Chicago they said you could serve shit on a stick so long as you're at an outdoor restaurant. And people will line up around the block. I haven't thought of that in years, but that was one of the comments. That was before there were food critics and foodies for that matter. Long time ago. Yeah. So you were asking.
I was going to say, so how does XRT get involved with Chicago? Well, you know, I was researching this and looking, and I was at Chicago Fest. I actually was writing stuff for the Illinois Entertainer. And one thing I did notice, I was telling them in Springfield, was, man, there were a lot of radio stations there.
Well,
that whole pavilion, there was just tons of GN, I think Harry Carey, Bozo, everybody was there.
Everybody was there. Yeah. Harry Carey was friends with Bozo, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Didn't they go out drinking
yeah.
together?
Yeah.
Where they're like honking their noses at each other. The thing was that it was a ritual. And it was and the people of Chicago came out in droves to this bombed out, you know, peninsula, human peninsula in the middle of Lake Michigan. And it was not the anybody who knows who's familiar with Navy Pier in its current form, you know, for the last 15, 20 years, I guess, you know, it is a tourist destination. Some Chicagoans don't go there anyway because it's meant for people from out of town, but other people take advantage of some of the options there culturally and otherwise, food-wise. It's a great place, and it's on a beautiful day. It's a wonderful place to see shows. I come to think of it, we'll go into that as well. But the thing is that for Chicago Fest, and Mayor Byrne started that, right? She was the person who invented it. And was 70, would 79 be the first year, or was it 80? I don't know when she was elected exactly.
I have to look that up.
She, well, Blandick lost the election,
yeah.
So it was sometime in 79, but I bet she couldn't put together Chicago Fest in time. So it must have been 1980 that was the first Chicago Fest. And now, so that was the first time I experienced it. And At the time, it was a place for every radio station to be represented. They had a little booth with a microphone and speakers pointed towards the crowd. And each radio station, rock stations and top 40 stations, and, you know, every single format in Chicago would be there to be in front of their audiences, potentially. But the biggest station in town at the time, and this is 1979, 1980, was The Loop. WLUP, you know, and the most iconic, and that word wasn't used very much back in 1980, the most iconic design of was the T-shirt, the you know, which people associated with hooliganism. When we competed against The Loop and later in the 80s, invariably when the local TV news would show people being arrested for, you know, selling drugs or major crimes, invariably they were being carted away by police who were, you know, and these guys had Loop shirts on. You know, yeah, with the classic logo, and they were covering their faces, and all you could see was the Loop shirts on. So these were hooligans. No two ways around it. But those were the most common. That was the most common attire at the at Chicago Fest for all those years. Mm. People would even bring them out of mothballs. Well, they resuscitated that years later when they were trying to, you know, regain their past
glory.
You see
that in some of the photos and stuff we've been looking at, all those Loop T-shirts.
Well, and the other part of it was they sold beer of every description there, and that was before the craft beer era.
Yeah, right.
So mostly they're barely drinkable beers. You know, worth noting that XRT, which was responsible for the blues stage, was sponsored by Olympia Beer.
Yeah.
No, has anyone had an Olympia beer?
Remember how sexy that was when we were in high school? Oh, I got Olympia beer.
Dreadful. Yeah. Well, Stroh's was out there. I mean, we could we could do a piece just on beers of the 80s.
Yeah.
But that should have been a radio station format.
If you can just kind of paint a visual picture of when you would walk down the Midway, maybe look. I mean, were you surprised at all the different radio stations over there? And what else was there? I think there was a carousel a couple years. I know Siskel and Ebert had a little theater one time. Then I read that the city closed that down because there were rats in the theater after one. But visually, what do you remember about the scene at Navy Pier for people who don't get what Navy Pier was then?
Can I set the stage just by going back in time, just like, not even a full year, two weeks before I arrived in August 1979, a little event called the Disco Demolition took place.
Oh, I know.
And that was totally, well, it's the only time, the first time, you know this, the first time a Major League Baseball game had ever been forfeited, ever. Yeah. And it was because of a DJ prank, and obviously it's had its anniversary in recent years, and people were reading a lot of significance into, you know, what was behind it, what was behind the crowd response and all that stuff. But, you know, we won't go there at this time. But the thing is that there was no bigger rock station in America in 1979 and 1980 than The Loop. And so, you know, this predated by 1 year the existence of Chicago Fest. But when 1980 summer came around, every single Loop fan, all of those Loopers were there in their T-shirts and stacking up the plastic beer cups. To me, that was the most memorable visual that I have of walking up and down Navy Pier, you know, constantly, because I was still taking it in. I was still learning about what the city was about. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to listen to anybody who thought they were a genius or know-it-all telling me about Chicago. I was just a cumulative knowledge that I gathered. You know, I've lived here now for over 40 years. I'm still learning. You know, but the thing is that The Loop was what it was all about. WMET was another rock station on the FM that took on The Loop the same way that WCFL and WLSAM battled each other in the top 40 wars in previous years. But Little XRT was a blues station. Little XRT selling, you know, Olympia beer and offering, you know, artists for the fans that really weren't attracting big crowds for the most part. And until you got to the lineup that, you know, we presented in 1980, and that was a whole different ballgame. So All of these people, all these partisans from different radio stations wearing their radio station uniforms, essentially, and having trying to drink as much beer as they possibly could. And some of them on the younger end, in young 20s, mid-20s, fake ID, so, you know, younger than that, you know, they were very wobbly as the day went on, being outside in the heat.
I didn't card all my Chicago Fest programs and notes with me, but the one thing everybody who, the people who were there talk about, and I know you know this, about how diverse that thing was booked. I mean, they had stuff, I'm just going off with my memory now, but, you know, they, we were talking earlier, a Big Twist in the Mellow Fellows. They had Eddie Rabbit or something like that. They had Henny Youngman. They had a Hispanic band.
It was fabulous.
It was
yeah.
really a melting pot, yeah. the way yeah. they approached it, you know. It was, everything was there.
Yeah, really.
Do you
was.
Remember that?
Yeah, 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 absolutely. That was one of the most impressive things about it. It was like what rock festivals used to be in there. In their infancy, yeah. where you have a little bit of every musical genre and from all eras too. Like, you know, Henny Youngman yeah. transcended time.
Yeah.
You know, and he was
well,
still
Sinatra
going,
played Chicago.
Take my
yeah.
wife, please.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I saw John Lee Hooker at Chicago.
Sure, and... sure. And so the blues stage, you know, so here was
yeah, so coming, XRT gets involved. Well, well blues
let me,
deluxe.
Let me
yeah,
put this into context. Yeah, okay. There was a going around in 1979, 1980, in radio stations around America, local radio stations. Radio stations back in 1979, 1980 or so were putting out these hometown albums of their local bands, unknown local bands that generally remained unknown local bands after the release of the album. I came to Chicago, my revelation as a music fan, you know, as someone who really takes music very seriously, it's where I was raised. I was a jazz snob growing up in New York. I saw all the great musicians, you know, dragged out there by my older sisters and stuff. And I was visiting blues clubs when I was living in Boston and when I, you know, where I started my career in radio. And I was familiar with a lot of these blues artists. And as I saw them playing in my neighborhood, you know, living in, you know, in Lakeview and living and walking down the street and going to the South Side and seeing all of these immortal artists playing on a Tuesday night, better music you'd hear anywhere
yeah,
else.
Right.
What came to me was instead of us putting out a promotional album with local artists, no shortage of great local bands, we have some of the greatest musicians in the world playing in the blues bars in Chicago. Let's find a handful of great blues artists and convince them to play on our record. And where were they all playing? They were playing at Navy Pier. They were playing at Chicago Fest in 1980. So we talked to Bruce Siglauer from Alligator. We talked to Scott Cameron, who managed Muddy and Mighty Joe Young. You know, we had all of these artists, Lonnie Brooks, who played my Welcome Mr. Norm party at Kingston Mines. And all of these artists, Coco Taylor, you know, some of whom I knew beforehand, you know, before I moved to Chicago. But they all agreed to let us record their sets. And with their approval, we would put them on an album. And the album... Which captured, well, you've got the list. Why don't you read off the names?
We got side A on vinyl. Here is vinyl. Vinyl's back, Norm.
Yes, indeed. it's still back. Yeah.
The Lonnie Brooks Band, the Sun Seals Blues Band.
What did Lonnie Brooks play on this album?
You got glasses on, but I can't. Of course, he did Sweet Home Chicago, right?
The penultimate version.
Yeah, right.
Of Sweet Home Chicago. Made the Blues Brothers rest in peace.
Sure, of course, yeah. Sun Seals Blues Band, Mighty Joe Young, and side B is.
First cut, second side.
Yeah. Muddy Waters.
Muddy Waters.
Yeah, Coco Taylor and Willie Dixon and the Chicago Blues All-Stars.
So that's a decent lineup of artists, right? Those would be like household names. Those are like legends.
Yeah.
So we were blown away. And actually, speaking of being blown away, there was a nor'easter the night that Muddy Waters played his set.
Oh, really?
And we were lucky to get in enough music
really?
To be able to have him stay on the stage and the crowd to be there safely along Navy Pier for them not to be threatened by the lightning and the thunder, but, you know, stuff like that happens when a god like Muddy hits the stage.
For sure.
So, you know, we just grabbed enough song, and it's not one of Muddy's greatest performances, but it was historical, and a lot of people were there. And the rest of the lineup, you know, speaks for itself. Classic versions of some of the songs some of those artists have played all their lives.
Are these photo reserve? Are these Natkin pictures?
Yes, they are.
Our friend Paul Natkin?
Yes, they are.
He's been around forever.
Yes, he has. Yeah, he's seen it all. And he's captured it all.
And you can turn it off and on.
So was this, you talked about the Chicago Blues Archive, was this...
Well, what happened
talk
was...
Talk about where the destiny of this project.
Well, thanks to Bruce Siglauer and the folks from our friends from Alligator Records, you know, we put this out as the first and only release on XRT Records, and the XRT
label. Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, it's true, and you can see it down there on the label, you know. But the fact, hold it by the edges, will you, Dave? Jeez, you know better than that. But
look at that, XRT Blues.
So the old logo. But the thing is that, you know... it was distributed by Alligator. Uh-huh. So we knew we'd get into all the record stores and we'd be in all the places that needed to be. And we'd be promoting the heck out of it on the radio. We didn't realize it would sound that great that we'd be playing all those songs on the radio. And even other stations against whom we competed at the time, like WMET, were playing Lonnie's version of Sweet Home Chicago because it's an anthem right there. It's supposed to be an anthem, and it was. So what we decided to do was, we're not making money off this deal. The idea was to do it for a good cause. And at the time, believe it or not, there was not any real legit Chicago Blues Museum or institution of any kind. And so we talked to the people from the city and Bruce and I, and we decided that we would devote all, we would contribute, what's the word? We would donate. All net proceeds from the cost of making the album to create a Chicago Blues Archive. And initially, it was, we got Scott Cameron, we saw some of the aforementioned artists, managers, and labels to give us like sheet music, Muddy Waters songs that he wrote, or Willie Dixon's manuscripts, or
you'll see some of that at State of Sound. Things like that. There's a plug for so what we're doing. Yeah.
So initially it was at what was then called the Chicago Public Library Cultural Center, now the Cultural Center, you know, at Randolph and Michigan Avenue. When the Harold Washington Museum opened, I guess 10 years later, they wound up moving everything to there, to a beautiful spot, you know, and that's and I was there on opening day. I mean, opening day. Yeah, and not the ballpark, but opening day at the Harold Washington Museum, just to see where they were putting it, and it was thrilling. Now, this album was submitted for a Grammy Award. Now, every album that comes out every year, and usually, you know, back in those days was Muddy or B.B. King. You know, so we lost. I was there in a tuxedo and a pair of sneakers, and Gary Owens from Laugh-In was announcing the nominees. It was astounding, and we lost to B.B. King. But I thought, my God, imagine that, a little Chicago radio station on the Northwest Side, you know, losing to B.B. King for Best Traditional Blues Album of the Year. Man, oh man. So that was thrilling. That was exciting to us.
And it came out in different formats. It came out in cassette.
I brought it to rarities.
It came out in CD?
It came out in CD, years later.
Years later. Is it still available now?
I don't know. I bet it's on. I would bet it's on in Spotify. They got a 100 gazillion CDs, but you know, but it's a rarity. And you know, I've got that copy there. You've got, and I've also got this copy that I think you captured photographically. Yeah. If only Paul Natkin were here today. Yeah. You know, he would need the steady hand. But we had it autographed by all of the artists who participated, which is, you know, a historical document.
Who came up with the cover idea?
That's a good question. Let me see. It's got to say it on the back. Look at that. Olympia.
What is it? I don't even know what kind of car. Is that a Rolls
Royce? Art Direction Design, Ross and Harvey, Inc., Chicago. So that might have been somebody.
Is that a Rolls Royce? I don't know what kind of car that is. Anyway, it's a fancy car on the cover.
Fancy car. Could have been a, I don't know. Yeah, okay. We know to ask. Yeah. Mobile recording. But thanks to Freddie Breitberg, who's the engineer who wound up being the house engineer, basically, for some of those great Alligator years. And of course, to Bruce Iglauer, the founder of Alligator, because it you know, wouldn't happen without him. It's great.
Couple more things.
Oh, and we mixed the album and engineered it and so on. And I helped with that.
Oh, you mentioned
at the historic Kurtom Studios, on Lincoln Avenue, which was where Kurtom Records, the great Curtis Mayfield hung out, and until he moved to Atlanta, I think, and L.A.
Yeah, right.
You know, later in his career.
End of his years was in the Atlanta area.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Chicago Fish show? I mean, it's going back. A gig you saw, a singer. Some people do talk about Sinatra.
I didn't get to see that one.
All the years, was there any one artist, even an emerging artist?
Ooh, man. My mind hasn't been thinking that way. Yeah. There was so much great stuff there, and it does all kind of mush together. And it must have been the heat of the sun that
the diversity is what, just in a general picture.
Well, there were so many white every musical genre. I mean, that's how it was organized with a radio station that matched up with that. Uh-huh. Because, you know, even today, radio stations choose one, you know, form of music, one vintage of music to play. So there were great, well, at the time, classic rock bands, even though they were from just a few years before that, you know. Yeah. Cheap Trick, I think, has done some great shows there, you know, and I remember that. But, you know, just the combination, the juxtaposition of artists that you could see from, you know, like at a festival, from one stage to another, you know, back to back to back to back. You know, I think in 1980, I was more obsessed with just the idea of putting this record together. Yeah. So I was mostly like sticking nearby and making sure nobody wandered off with our microphones or something like that, or all the Olympia beer.
Finally, we'll talk to two members and the manager from the popular Chicago rhythm and blues band, Max Trax, and formerly Third Rail, about their experience of performing at Chicago Fest.
just what was the vibe like at Navy Pier when you guys were there?
Oh, wow. Well, I believe we opened for Kool & the Gang. Richie, am I right? Is that what we opened up for?
I want to say we played there twice. One time on the blue stage and earlier in the day, and then one year on the main stage opening for Kool & the Gang.
Yeah, actually, 81 was, I think, on the Olympia stage, maybe.
Yeah.
And then 82 was the Kool & the Gang experience. And then I think in 83, the band actually played again, but that was when it was moved to Soldier Field.
Right.
Okay. And that was an afternoon slot.
And what was, I mean, you know, I think what was the pier like? The pier, of course, people should know, the pier is nothing like it is today.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I can describe the Chicago Fest format, I believe, was adopted from Milwaukee Summer Fest. And I think it was a Jane Byrne project. So what that looked like was along the water, so that would be the south side of the pier, they had multiple stages. They had, I want to say they had a jazz stage, a rock stage, I think they call it Rock Around the Dock, the blues stage, a comedy stage.
Uh-huh.
I think that was it. And then there was a main stage that was further west. And they would...
Go ahead, I'm sorry. There was no gospel stage at that time.
I don't think so.
No. There was no gospel stage.
They would book acts, I want to say, from maybe as early as 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., something like that, all day long. I think each act got 1 or 2 hours each.
Sure.
And there was some tremendous big-name acts, as I'm sure your display will show. But I remember when we played on the blues stage, we stayed and watched the Neville Brothers after us.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Murray can describe the whole thing with Lou Valpano and everything with the Kool & the Gang. But my biggest memory of that I have fond memories of was we started to do our set, and the reaction was so enthusiastic that it drew Kool & the Gang out of their dressing room to see what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
And not only did that happen, but it was unheard of, an unknown opening, non-national opening act. We got an encore.
Yes, we did.
The crowd insisted on an encore. And so that was sort of validation for all we had been through. We were sort of at the peak of our powers at that point.
Yeah.
How many pieces were in the band then?
Seven?
Two guitars, two keyboards.
Seven.
Double keyboards.
Right. Two guitars, two keyboards, bass, drums, percussion.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly.
Do you remember the demographics of the crowd? Young, old, black, white, how many black people were in the crowd? Chicago, I'm going to get into that in a minute, but do you remember what the crowd looked like?
Well, in Chicago, it's one thing, even though it's a polarized, segregated city, one of the most in the country, not the world. When it comes to music, it doesn't make a difference. That's one thing I've found to be the tie that binds us all together, even in times of racial turbulence, like to say, in music has always been the panacea that fixes everything, makes everything all right, right? And that's even to this day, it does the same thing.
Although, Murray, you can tell the political story, but there's a political racial component to that particular slot.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. We did talk to Kathy Byrne and we talked about the boycott. But yeah, talk about how you went. I think you said before you were going to not play. Well, talk about the boycott, what it was about, and then how you made your decisions.
Well, the boycott in 82 was led by Jesse Jackson. He said that there weren't enough African-American companies involved in the festival, and he asked for a boycott. And as I remember it, Stevie, and there was also a sense that there might be some protesting or going on. And Stevie Wonder was supposed to be the headliner that night. And I believe Kool & the Gang was supposed to open for Stevie Wonder. Stevie decided to pull out, and the reason they gave was for safety concerns. So that kind of bumped Kool & the Gang up. And for a while, they didn't want to do it. And then their concerns, their fears were kind of allayed, and they decided to do it. And based on the popularity that Third Rail was experiencing at that time in the city, we got a call from Lou Valpano, who was in charge of the entertainment for the festival, asking us if we would open for Kool & the Gang, which caused us a lot of discussion in the band, only because of the band was popular. We fortunately had a diverse following, but still the whole ethical thing about Jesse Jackson calling for the boycott and a band that was primarily a black band crossing the picket line, so to speak, what the implications might be for the band in terms of like publicity or their following. So it really came down to kind of like a personal issue of what was morally and ethically right and what would be best for the band at that time in terms of their career. And the decision was made by the band to play the date, which we did. And
Was it a unanimous decision?
Yeah, I don't think it was. I don't think there was much bickering over it.
I took myself out of the vote.
And
I defer to you, brothers, that's not what you vote on. I think one of the turning points was Jesse Jackson did come out and say, I have no issue with any of the performers, you know, crossing or, you know, honoring their commitments.
Right. Exactly. So that kind of made it okay. I mean, once he stated that position.
Right.
You know, because we, you know, or musicians are not political. And I don't think they should be. That doesn't mean that we don't stand up for injustice or evil when it's being perpetrated, because I think you get more strength to things that are not right when you have a platform or a means to say, to influence people if you feel that strongly. But for the most part, Ms. Artists are free of that. It's just because it does not, it's not a, those negatives are not a component of the art that we do, you know. So it's, you know, so that was all, that was my problem. If I had a problem with crossing or not, I didn't really have one, to be quite honest with you, you know.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.